On our last session, we finished up the prophecies that Jacob was giving his sons, and the last one was Joseph. And this was an extraordinarily long prophecy because Joseph was so well loved by Jacob. He had done so much, and Jacob knew that Joseph was worthy, and Joseph loved God. There is no mention of Joseph intentionally sinning anywhere in the scriptures, ever. I'm sure he did, because everyone is fallible. But he wasn't a rancorous guy, a scoundrel like his brothers. He was an innocent person that got railroaded, if you will, to use a modern term, into slavery and sent away to Egypt, where he ultimately becomes the prime minister. My goodness. Jacob took up the promises of fruitfulness with Joseph. He said that you would be fruitful. And this is going to happen through Ephraim. Joseph was victorious. Joseph had many, many, many conflicts. And the text that we looked at last week said that he did experience persecution. A lot of it from his brothers, from Potiphar, when Potiphar's wife falsely accused him of trying to sexually molest her. He had a difficult time, but then he became second only to Pharaoh in the greatest country in the world at that time. And the text that we looked at last week was using this imagery to show how his persecution was actually carried out. It was using it as though someone was shooting at him, like he was being hunted. The archers that sorely grieved him, they shot at him, they persecuted him. And this happened. He was severely mistreated, but he overcame all of them. Now, these prophecies that were given to Joseph are pointing to conflicts that are going to be from his descendants, too. And the victory that he got in battle, and the victory that was going to come through his descendants, was seen by Joshua, Deborah, Samuel, all the tribe of Ephraim, Gideon, Jephthah, and all the tribe that came from Manasseh. And what is so precious about this set of verses is the various descriptions of God. It's almost like God is surrounding Joseph, has chosen him from this, and the text wants us to know the different characteristics of God and the different names of God as it relates to Joseph. And these are some of the titles. There are just only eight of them I put down on your notes there. But the Mighty One of Jacob, the Shepherd, the Rock of Israel, your Father's God, the Almighty, the One who ensures blessings from the heavens above, the One who ensures blessings from the deeper below, and the One who ensures blessings from the breast and the womb. All of these characteristics of God are given in this section of Scripture to magnify Joseph and show him and show us that Joseph was indeed blessed, led by God, followed God, knew God, and wanted to please God. And above all, he trusted him. He trusted him. He knew in the worst circumstances that God was still there with him. He was right down there in the jails with him. He was right down there in the pit where his brothers had put him. Yeah, he was crying and wailing. He was just a 17-year-old kid. But he knew the Lord. He knew the Lord. And the Lord saved him out of all of that. Joseph gets the double blessing. Now, we remember now that Joseph was chosen by his dad, Jacob, to be the firstborn, or to take the status of the firstborn after Reuben sinned. Reuben was an unsettled character, the firstborn of Leah, and he had good qualities, but he really fell apart when he had intercourse with his father's concubine. That just ruined him from getting the preeminence in the firstborn position. So Jacob split it up. Judah ended up getting the preeminence, which would mean that the Messiah would come through his line, and Joseph got the double portion of the worldly goods and the blessings that could come. He replaced Reuben in that position. The text that we looked at last week then went on to the final person of Jacob's 12 sons, which is Benjamin. And Benjamin was the last, the youngest. He got a very small piece of territory, but it was in a very difficult spot because it was right adjacent to Judah and the other tribes. It was just on the north side of Judah, near Jerusalem, a spot where there has been a lot of wars. The imagery in the text that we looked at last week portrays him, or at least his progeny, as warlike and predatory. And he wasn't like that himself, but because of where he was given that property, his progeny became like that. Ehud was one of the judges, and he was a Benjamite. Deborah, during the Civil War, it said that they mustered 26,000 men with swords and 700 crack slingers. And they fought back savagely against the other tribes. I mean, these guys turned out to be very, very strong warriors. And it's all because of where their geography was situated. They had to fight. And just like Israel today, Israel has to fight. Israel's in a land with a lot of crummy neighbors that want to just beat them up, and they're not going to let them. They've won every battle that they have engaged in since they became a state. Every one. And most of them in the early days were without sufficient arms. They pushed back mighty nations like the Egyptians, who at that time had a massive army in 1948. Jews didn't have anything except old World War I weapons that Czechoslovakia gave them. And this is the same situation here we see with Benjamin. Same situation. Provided skilled archers. Two of David's heroes came from this tribe, Abiezer and Ribai. And it's all because of the geography. Some of the famous guys that came from here were Jonathan, Saul's son, Saul as well, and Mordecai and Esther, in the book of Esther, and the Apostle Paul was a Benjamite. So there's other references to this tribe that I put down there, and as you go through those, you can see the general warlike characteristics of these folks that came from Benjamin. And then we looked at the death of Jacob. I'm going to pass by that section for now because I'm going to pick it up with today's material. I just want to go to what I've called the epilogue here and finish up the review with that. The designation of Jacob's 12 sons, also known as the 12 tribes of Israel, appears about 10 times just with that reference, without any individual names attached to it in the Old Testament. However, there's 24 other appearances where those names are shown, and they're listed in one order or another. And in your notes last week, I put all of those down, and I listed all the orders. If you weren't here last week, ask me, and I'll get a copy out to you of that. You can see where each one of the listings, where it came from, and what the actual sequence of the listings was. And they all differ slightly from one another. It's not 100% clear why the Lord did this. I can tell you that there's no happenstance in the Bible. There's a reason for that. We just don't know exactly what it is. And I've heard a lot of speculation that's really not worthy of passing on because it's just all guessing. Nobody really knows. But they are listed in different orders. And because you have Joseph being divided into two, Ephraim and Manasseh, it produces 11. And sometimes Joseph's even listed and the other two aren't. And sometimes one of the other ones is not shown, like Dan is not shown in the evangelistic crusade of the Great Tribulation. It's just not clear why that has happened. But at different times, for different reasons, God has chosen to only have some of them and not all of them. But it's always 12. Almost every time, as I remember, it's always 12. The actual birth order of these guys, it starts with Leah, who is the first wife, and she gives birth to Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. That's 1, 2, 3, 4. And then later, after she gives birth to Issachar and Zebulun. So there's two more, but they're number 9 and 10. So Leah was the most fruitful of the wives that he had. Bilhah, Rachel's slave, gives birth to Dan and Naphtali, number 5 and 6. Zilpah, who was Leah's slave, gives birth to Gad and Asher. And then finally, Rachel, his beloved wife, gave birth to Joseph, and then she died in childbirth with Benjamin. So we think that she was probably like 39, 40 years old when she passed. Manasseh and Ephraim are often listed separately, and sometimes because of the way Manasseh's territory has two different geographies, that sometimes they're listed separately, east and west Manasseh. So it's really not clear why it is that way in the Bible, but it's a great fertile environment for speculation. What I've done, and what I did last week here and recreated here, is I put down the Hebrew meaning of the names. And each Hebrew name has meaning. Some of our English translations, as a matter of fact, will put the meaning down instead of the name. They will translate it that way. Instead of saying the name, they will put down the translation. I see this in the prophets pretty frequently. So Reuben is Sia's son. Simeon is heard. Levi is joined. Judah prays. Dan he judged. Naphtali wrestled. Gad fortune. Asher happy. Issachar hire or reward. Zebulun is honor. Joseph he adds. And Benjamin son of the right hand. Or son of the south, and then Manasseh is making to forget, and Ephraim to be fruitful. So you can play with those lists, and as I said, if you weren't here last week, I'll get those notes to you so you can see how those lists are all laid out. But it's kind of fun to play with them and the names and see what kind of a little sentence you can put together, a little story. The death of Jacob came right after he had finished prophesying to his children. He was ready to die when he got Joseph and said, look, I need to talk to you. And he changed the birth order in terms of the blessing between his two sons. He reversed it. He gave them blessings. And he told Joseph, you have to carry me back to Canaan. I don't want to get buried here. I can't get buried here. And Joseph promised him. They made a solemn oath. And Jacob then gives up his life, gives up the ghost, if you will. He's done with the prophecy. He's done with his life. And he says that he wants to be buried back in Canaan in the cave at Machpelah. And if you remember, the cave at Machpelah was where Leah is, because this is where we find out that where she was buried. We didn't know this before. I brought this out earlier. You know, I kind of fast forward when we were talking about Leah and showed you the prophecy here that where she had died and where she was buried. This is not where Rachel was buried, though. Rachel was buried in Bethlehem. Rachel's grave is one of the monuments in Israel today. Whether it's exactly there or not, not clear, but that's where they honor her. We know that that's where she was originally buried. But what I think is so unique about this is that Jacob wants to be buried where Leah is. She tried to get close to him her whole life and couldn't get close to him. She loved him and she wanted him, but he wanted Rachel. He thought he got shortchanged by Laban, and in a sense he did. So, as a result, it appears from the text that Leah was not as beautiful. Matter of fact, she may have been somewhat homely, but she was a loving mother, a caring person. She was a real Proverbs 31 mother person. And I think Jacob, over time, recognized that as he did his other faults, as he turned closer to God. And that's where he wanted to be buried, eternally, to have his body there laying with his wife Leah and his father and her wife, Isaac and Rebekah, and his grandfather and grandmother, Abraham and Sarah. He drew his feet up on the bed, and he was sitting there right in front of all these kids. He's got all these kids in front of him, and he just dies. He said, I'm done. I'm done. He gives up the ghost. He was 147 years old. He had a lot of sins, as we saw going through his life, but he was still led by God. He was chosen by God, and he loved God. But his relationship to God was one that was developed over time because he resisted so much that God had for him. But he got it all. He got it all. It's just he kind of did it in a circuitous way. He didn't do it straight ahead and just attach himself to God and be a child of God, led by God all the time. But in the end, he was. In the end, he was. 147 years. He died as a man, a genuine and great faith. He learned where his blessings came from. He knew that his blessings came from God. God met with him. The angel of the Lord fought with him, wrestled with him, changed his name to Israel, started a new nation from him. And he had this privilege to hand this on to his sons. They would be the nation Israel. And as we said before, there were 70 of them at that time that went into Egypt, including Joseph, 70 of them. And when they came out of Egypt 400 years later, it was over 2 million. The most conservative estimate I've seen is 2.2 million. They came out a huge nation for that point in time. He knew that his progeny was going to populate the world because, amongst other places, in Genesis 32:12, the text says they are going to be as the sands of the sea. And they have. They've become a major nation on this earth, small in size but powerful in this world. Israel, for a little teeny piece of real estate, is in the news every day. And the politicians are constantly talking about, what do we do about Israel? What is the president doing? Why did he not meet with the prime minister? I mean, it's every day there's something about Israel. They are a huge, huge player. There isn't any other nation on the face of this earth that stopped being a sovereign nation for 2,500 years and then came back as a sovereign nation that has world preeminence. And it's just a little teeny thing on the map. Just think about that. It's like having Rhode Island as a major world power, you know. It just doesn't happen. It has to be that God is leading them back, just like he said he would. The text then moves on. From Genesis 50, we're starting in the last chapter here. Verses 1 to 3 says, and Joseph fell upon his father's face and wept upon him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. And the physicians embalmed Israel. And 40 days were fulfilled for him, for so are fulfilled the days of those which are embalmed. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. Joseph loved his dad. He loved him unconditionally, and his dad loved Joseph. You know, he knew where Joseph was going, or Joseph knew where Jacob was going. It wasn't a mystery. He knows God. He knows a year after. He knew that, but you still miss the person that's gone. You know, their animation stops. You can't talk to them. There's no movement, and you know where they are. We don't mourn like the heathen do. The heathen go on for weeks, maybe months and years. They never get over this because they don't understand it. What we are missing when a loved one dies is we are missing that immediate interaction we have with them. We're missing the animation, but we know where they are. And our mourning lasts, but not as long as the heathen. Not as long as the heathens do. We know where they are. Joseph was reflecting on his life experiences with his dad. You know, everything, when somebody close to you dies, your mind just flashes back to all the experiences you had, and all Joseph had was great experiences with his father. Great experiences. He was a good son. He did what his dad wanted him to do. And as a result, they had a great relationship. His father had chosen him more than once to have a preeminent position. Sometime in the future, death will be overturned. There won't be any physical death. We are all going to have resurrected bodies. And Revelation 21:4 says that there won't be any more sting of death. There won't be any more sting. It will be gone. The animation is gone. He felt the loss, and he closed his father's eyes. He closed his father's eyes. And we see that that was prophesied in Genesis 46:4, that Joseph would close his father's eyes. So what goes on from here is the embalming and the funeral and finally the burial. Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. Now, in ancient Egypt, they embalmed the royalty, and if anybody could afford it, that was not royalty, that was not part of the high ranking or the wealthy, you could buy an embalmer. And the embalmers that they used, there was professional embalmers. It was what we would call it, the undertaker today. But the embalmer did something a lot more than what an undertaker does here today. They were magicians. And they would bless the organs and dedicate them to Horus, one of their gods. Joseph wanted to avoid this. He did not want that at all. But he had to embalm the body because it was going to go back to Canaan. And it couldn't be decomposing before he got it back. So he had to go through the embalming process, at least partially. So he chose his physicians to do this, not the professional embalmers. And I put together a general summary of this embalming process because Herodotus, the ancient Greek historian, lived from 484 to 425 B.C., describes it in quite detail. I've just only pulled out segments of what he said because he's a lot more detailed than I think would be necessary to go into here. He said that there was a period of 70 days for embalming and mourning. Body was laid on a wooden table, and then it was washed with a solution of something called natron in water. And the natron evidently was a chemical of some sort, and it was a part of a drying agent, if I understand it correctly. And so in order to dry the body completely, they had to take out all the internal organs, and they started with the brain. The Egyptians would just discard the brain because they just didn't think it had any usefulness for the hereafter or for that body coming back to life. So they just discarded it. They thought the heart, though, had great value. So the brain was just pulverized and then thrown out. Palm wine and frankincense was used to flush out the cranial cavity. And then after they removed the internal organs, they put them, first they washed them in frankincense, myrrh, and palm wine. And then they dried them with natron. And then they put them into these canisters called canoptic jars, and that in the tops of these jars were shaped like the heads of their Egyptian gods. They dedicated these organs to their Egyptian gods, the four sons of Horus. Now, these were genies, as the Egyptians would deem them, and that's what Joseph was avoiding. He didn't want to go through this at all. He wasn't going to have anything to do with it. And he had stayed really wholesome the whole time he was there. He knew Jehovah God. He knew who he was. He had no problem staying close to God. None whatsoever. So, you know, he distanced himself even as prime minister from this process. He distanced himself from it. And here's a perfect example. When the body was treated with this natron and the salt for 7 days, it caused a very rapid dehydration, but it didn't let it decompose. It didn't let it decompose. So he went through the normal process of embalming, with the exception of the administration of these magical arts for the organs. And it was treated then with pitch, gums, and resin. So if you've ever seen a mummy in a museum, you see that they've got this resin-type cover on them. That's what they put on it after they had dried the body and they'd filled the cranial cavities and taken out the organs. Then they covered it with this resin and pitch, and the body would be preserved. I mean, they found these things that are several thousand years old, and they still are preserved, reasonably preserved. I mean, they don't look like us walking around, but, you know, they look like a mummy. And finally, they put it in a mummy case. Then it goes on to say that 40 days were fulfilled for him, for so are fulfilled the days of those which are embalmed. And that was a standard Egyptian process. The standard mourning period for Jews was also 40 days. And the Egyptians mourned him for 70 days. So they mourned him for 70 days. This is how well-loved Joseph and his dad were. How much honor they gave his dad because of Joseph and because of his dad. They knew that these people came from God. They just didn't know God. But they knew that these guys were special. They were absolutely special. To mourn somebody for 70 days in Egyptian society was a rigorous administration of a lot of rights and a lot of restraint on personal behavior to honor him and constantly honor him and think about him. So this was really an honor. And this is why Joseph had Jacob embalmed, so he could take him through this process of the 70 days and then all the way back to Canaan so the body wouldn't be decomposed. It had to be preserved. Starting in the fourth verse of the 50th chapter and reading to the ninth, the text says, "And when the days of his mourning were past, Joseph spake unto the house of Pharaoh, saying, If now I have found grace in your eyes, speak, I pray you, in the ears of Pharaoh, saying, My father made me swear, saying, Lo, I die in my grave, which I have digged for me in the land of Canaan. There shalt thou bury me. Now therefore, let me go up, I pray thee, and bury my father, and I will come again. And Pharaoh said, Go up and bury thy father, according as he made thee swear. And Joseph went up to bury his father, and with him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, and all the house of Joseph, and his brethren, and his father's house. Only their little ones, and their flocks, and their herds, they left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with them both chariots and horsemen, and it was a very great company." When the mourning process passed, Joseph didn't approach Pharaoh directly, and there are tons of speculation on why that is, but he went to the administrators in the house of Pharaoh. He went to the palace, and he talked to the intermediaries, the counselors, and he says, "If I have found grace in your eyes, speak, I pray you, in the ears of Pharaoh, saying, My father made me swear, saying, Lo, I die in the grave, which I have digged for me in the land of Canaan. There shalt thou bury me." Joseph was always a very polite, humble, and gracious guy. He knew his position under Pharaoh, and he knew it well. He just didn't want to burst in there and say, "Look, you got to let me do this." He wanted to go through the normal, custom, polite channels to approach Pharaoh with a request of this nature, because this is going to be an army following these guys and a huge number of dignitaries. It's not just the family, the 70 family members going back. This is huge. This is really huge. The royal permission was also required to go past the Egyptian boundaries. They just couldn't go outside of Egypt without permission from Pharaoh. So this was a delicate situation. But since Joseph had promised his dad, he swore to his dad, it was an oath. They confirmed that oath with the hand under the thigh, the signatory, if you will, for, yeah, I'm going to do this. And he was going to Pharaoh to ask him that, but he did it through his courtiers. And Pharaoh said, "Go up and bury thy father according as he made thee swear." Pharaoh knew that Joseph was a wholesome, earnest guy, and he wanted to go bury his dad, and he would come back. He knew that he'd come back. He had this high position. He was an administrator to the crown. He'd saved Egypt. He saved them during this famine. So they really respected him because life continued when it could have faded, it could have died. So after he got the permission from Pharaoh to go back to Canaan, he gets this large company, and it's all the servants of Pharaoh's, the elders of his house, and all the elders of the land of Egypt. Now, this was all the officers of the court, of the state, of high-ranking society, as well as his family, the elders in his family, and in all the house of Joseph, his brethren in his father's house. So he got all the family to go, excepting only their children and flocks, also chariots and horsemen. So there just wasn't any reason to take back the kids or to take the flocks. There just wasn't any reason. But chariots and horsemen, and they had an escort of a very large army. I mean, you can only imagine how many people this was. It had to have been 400 or 500 at least, going through the desert, through the Sinai, up into Canaan. Just a splendid group of people in procession, a funeral procession with flags and ensigns and dressed and having this mummified casket there and the honor that was being bestowed them. It's like a huge military parade, you know, demonstrating honor for a high-ranking soldier that died in battle. It was incredible. Joseph was well-loved. He was well-loved because of the style of life that he led, being close to God. People see that. If you never even say it, people see it. They know how you live. They know how you think. They know that God lives within you. And people saw that in Joseph. That's what caused the envy. That's what caused the jealousy. That's what caused people to lash out against him. It's what caused him to have Potiphar's wife lie. And that's what caused Potiphar not to kill him, too. Because Potiphar was the chief executioner, and he could have easily killed Joseph had Joseph truly been coming on to his wife. Potiphar knew what his wife was like, and he knew what Joseph was like, but he had to do something. He had to do something official because his wife was screaming rape, and he knew it didn't happen. He knew what she was like, so he put him in jail. For insurance purposes, Pharaoh provides his army. And it was a very great company. Chariot, horsemen, a very great company. That was to ensure that they went safely and they came back safely. Let's look at the funeral procession's arrival. I mean, they go into great detail talking about this funeral. And they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond Jordan, and there they mourned with a great and very sore lamentation, and he made a mourning for his father 7 days. And when the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning in the floor of Atad, they said, "This is a grievous mourning to the Egyptians." Wherefore the name of it is called Abel Mitzrayim, which is beyond Jordan. And his sons did unto him according as he commanded them. For his sons carried him into the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of Machpelah, which Abraham bought with the field for a possession of a burying place of Ephron the Hittite before Mamre. So they travel to the threshing floor of Atad, which is a large open area. It's covered, but it's an open area where they would thresh the grain. They would separate out the grain from the wheat from the chaff, if you will. And the Canaanites were still there. This is not on the east side of the Jordan. This is on the west side of the Jordan, which will be what they would call at that time Cisjordan, C-I-S. And it was where the Canaanites were, so that's where it was. And they're calling it the West Bank today, but it's really Judea and Samaria in New Testament biblical times. The threshing floor in Hebrew is a goren. It's a large circular area where they used to tramp out corn or sift wheat. And they would have these oxen that were roving around in these long, around stiles, if you will. And the oxen's feet would crush out the corn. But it was large enough for them to accommodate this funeral procession. Because with all these people, hundreds of people, they had to have some place for them to go. The funeral takes place in two stages. There's this funeral service, if you will. It's what we would call it, at the threshing floor. And they had a great public mourning ceremony there. And that's a tod. But the Canaanites change it to the Abo Mitzrayim. And Mitzrayim is the Hebrew word for Egypt. So the folks there changed the name to Abel Mitzrayim. And here is where the formal Egyptian participation ceased, because the family then went on about a week later to the cave of Machpelah. And that's where the body was privately buried. So the family broke off from the rest of the Egyptians and traveled the rest of the way to the cave of Machpelah near Mamre. And it was just the local family. Just the local family, you know. We're probably talking 100 of them at least, maybe 150. Jacob did as his sons asked. Jacob's sons did as he asked, excuse me. They brought him back to Machpelah, which Abraham bought, by the way. Abraham bought property there. He bought property. And you may remember that Israel bought property too. Israel bought property. When he was on the way back from Haran with his group, and where Laban met with him for the last challenge, and then just before he met with his brother, who he thought he was going to have a war with, he bought property up there in the north too. The Jews have bought property in the past. Even though God gave them that, there was a couple of purchases that were also shown in the scripture. Abraham, Isaac, Rebekah, Leah, and Jacob are buried in the cave of Machpelah. Jacob's life finally comes to an end, and he's resting in the family burying place, awaiting resurrection like all of us will. When we all leave, our bodies will come back to life, and they'll leave this earth. And we will be joined together with the Lord with bodies that live forever. Amen. Let's pray.